zu Hilfe, sonst bin ich verloren. Zu Hilfe, sonst bin ich verloren. Ihr wisst, die Schlange zu Opfer kommen, barmherzige
Help, help, or I'm lost. A cunning serpent is chasing me. May the gods have mercy. It's getting closer. Save me. We're just over 1 minute into the opera, and the tenor has fainted. My name is Anthony Freud. I'm the general director of Lyric Opera of Chicago. And today, I'm going to speak about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's final opera, The Magic Flute. The musical excerpts in this commentary are furnished courtesy of Warner Music Group, the official education and promotional music provider of Lyric Opera. The recording features Kurt Moll as Zarastro, Peter Schreier as Tamino, Edda Moser as the Queen of the Night, Anneliese Rothenberger as Pamina, and Walter Berry as Papageno. Wolfgang Sawallisch conducts the orchestra and chorus of the Bavarian State Opera. And special thanks to Nicholas Ivor Martin for writing this commentary. Some productions of The Magic Flute try to ameliorate this decidedly unheroic opening. Many years ago, artist Maurice Sendak designed a magic flute for stage director Frank Corsaro. Corsaro had the tenor fire an arrow into the wings before the serpent's appearance, so at least he got off one shot before having the vapors. But this caused problems backstage. At each performance, the stage manager had to make sure everyone stage right ducked so no one would be impaled. In one of the early performances, the tenor's arrow hit the glass door on a fire panel, sending glass flying. The tenor was so overjoyed with his aim that he forgot his lines, all four of them. In subsequent performances, the stage crew hung a dartboard over the fire panel. None of this is how we expect an opera to begin. Heroes are supposed to be heroic. And heroic or not, tenors are supposed to make grander entrances. Often there is a rousing chorus to frame what's coming. And if there isn't a long build-up before the tenor's entrance, at least it should be vocally spectacular. Think of Otello's entrance at the beginning of Verdi's masterpiece. Also, why is he being chased by a snake? Many productions turn it into a dragon, but the German word for dragon is Drachen. Mozart's libretto says snake, Schlange. Of course, Schlange is also translated as serpent, which could at least be a big snake. And why is our hero asking the gods, plural, for mercy? Tamino, the tenor in question, is promptly rescued by three mysterious ladies who kill the snake in less time than it took Tamino to scream for help. They then notice how handsome Tamino is, and they bicker over who is going to tell the news to their queen. None of them wants to leave because they all want to stay behind with the beautiful stranger. So they compromise and leave together, abandoning the still unconscious tenor on a rocky landscape where we know there are dangerous animals. What is going on? The Magic Flute premiered on September 30th, 1791, and ever since, some audiences and critics have been calling it one of the silliest librettos ever written. Not everyone agreed. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, German master poet and author of Faust, cautioned that more knowledge is required to understand the value of this libretto than to mock it. Generations of interpreters have sided with Goethe. Presenting a work written centuries ago, in societies in which slavery was legal and misogyny and racism rampant, is almost always a challenge. A few works emerge from this test of fire unscathed, like many, but not all, of the plays of Shakespeare. More works of art are no longer presentable. Their thinking is simply too alien to modern audiences. Because opera is a weaving together of multiple art forms, it presents us with a third category. Works with immortal components bound to now objectionable words or concepts. the contemporary controversy over the works of Richard Wagner, who was embraced posthumously by Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich, is the most obvious example. The Magic Flute itself displays such challenges. Virtually every modern presentation of the opera redacts the more racist lines said about and by the villain Monostatos. But the Magic Flute creates its own category. There are many questions, not just about intent, but also about meaning. Is it misogynistic? Does it promote mysticism, specifically Freemasonry? Is it even an opera? The Magic Flute is one of those rare works that both requires and encourages each generation of interpreters to look deeper and find the eternal truths in Mozart's final opera. The opening of the opera introduces many of the themes that later interpreters have taken up, the most obvious being the fantastical world Mozart creates. Since when do snakes, even big ones, chase tenors across a rocky landscape? We're not in the real world. Tamino is a prince from an unnamed foreign land. The three ladies serve a queen of the night. When Tamino does wake up, he's greeted by Papageno, a bird catcher who dresses to look like the birds he traps. Tamino mistakenly thanks Papageno for saving his life, and Papageno not only accepts the credit, he invents a story about how he accomplished it. Papageno would have been a familiar figure to German audiences of Mozart's time. Hanswurst was a stock comic fictional character in German-speaking comedies, much like the Italians had Harlequin in their Commedia dell'arte. Hanswurst was not stupid, but he was no genius. He was cunning, a happy-go-lucky creature who knew how to work an angle. He was also a peasant and a coward. When Hanswurst was on stage, you knew something funny was going to happen. Mozart's Papageno is here for a reason. Although the composer was welcomed with open arms in all the courts of Europe, the Magic Flute was not a serious opera for a royal function. At the time of its premiere, the Magic Flute was not even considered an opera. Rather, it was a Singspiel, or song play, a German form that included spoken dialogue with the music. Singspiel was considered lowbrow. Flute premiered in Vienna a mere 24 days after Mozart had had the first performance of his La Clemenza di Tito in Prague. Clemenza was a true opera seria, the highbrow form of opera that was already falling out of fashion. As befitted serious art, opera seria followed prescribed musical forms. Overtures were expected to use a three-part sonata form. Arias followed a strict ABA form, with the final section elaborating and embellishing the music of the opening. These so-called da capo arias were used for emotional development, while plot was relegated to recitative, a rapid, declamatory way of setting music that was accompanied by harpsichord or other continuo instruments. Singspiel had no such discipline. Arias were not absolutely banned, but folk songs and ballads were expected, as were magical elements and comedy. Singspiel was entertainment for the masses. I mentioned that Papageno tries to take credit for saving Tamino's life. This is exactly what Hanswurst would have done. A well-dressed man, presumably rich, shows up expressing gratitude. Why not profit from his mistake? Unfortunately for Papageno, Hanswurst was cunning without necessarily being smart. Papageno knows he didn't kill the snake, but if he'd stopped to think about it, he also knows that someone else did. Someone powerful. In fairness, Papageno might not know how long the serpent has been dead. It's cold-blooded, after all, so we can't say the body's still warm. He might think the real serpent slayers are long gone. Only it's a comedy, so they're not. No sooner has Papageno made his ill-advised boast than the three ladies return and expose his lie. Fortunately for him, the punishment inflicted by the ladies is merely to padlock his mouth and warn him not to do it again. They do neglect to give him the wine, cake, and figs that are his usual payment. Papageno also works for the Queen of the Night, so the three ladies are his paymasters. Before again disappearing, the three ladies give Tamino a portrait of the Queen's beautiful daughter, Pamina. That's Tamino singing the opera's first serious aria, Dies Bildnis, in which he admits that he has already fallen in love with Pamina. That this princely tenor sings a classical aria is not a mistake. Singspiel freed Mozart from formal compositional constraints, but the music of the Magic Flute uses conventions to build the story. Tamino is an operatic hero, if occasionally a silly one. He was played by Benedict Schuck at the premiere, who was not only a singer, but also a composer and Kapellmeister. Papageno, by contrast, was played at the premiere by Emanuel Schikaneder, a friend of Mozart's and the owner of the theatre where the Magic Flute premiered. It was Schikaneder who wrote the libretto for the Magic Flute. His successful troupe was popular with the Viennese public. But because Schikaneder was not primarily a singer, Mozart made things easy for him. Not only is Papageno's music simpler to sing than Tamino's, the tune is usually stated first by the orchestra so the singer can easily find his pitch, and then doubled by them, reinforcing him if he gets into trouble. Tamino is not the only serious singer in the piece. No sooner has the tenor declared his love for the soprano than Tamino's hoped-for mother-in-law, the Queen of the Night, appears to sing a full-fledged opera aria. It's not a traditional da capo aria, but for all the embellishment and vocal technique required, it might be something straight out of opera seria. This is one of the two most famous arias for coloratura soprano in the repertoire, and both are sung by the Queen of the Night in the Magic Flute. Pamina has been kidnapped by Zarastro, whom the queen and her minions characterize as an evil sorcerer. If Tamino rescues her, the queen promises, he can have her. She arms him with a magic flute, which can turn sorrow into joy, a somewhat nebulous power, but never mind. The padlock is removed from Papageno's mouth, and he's ordered to go with Tamino. He is given magic bells to protect him, and three child spirits are detailed to show them the way. All of this is perfectly clear. Good guy, Tamino, bad guy, Zarastro. Comic relief, Papageno, Queen of the Night, motivator. Three genies, magical companions. Flute and bells, operatic weaponry. We now switch to Zarastro's palace, where Zarastro's chief slave, Monostatos, recaptures Pamina when she attempts to escape. This is plucky for an operatic heroine. On the way to Zarastro's palace, Tamino and Papageno have become separated, so Papageno actually gets to Pamina first. He finds her with Monostatos. Papageno and Monostatos are each terrified of the other, but Monostatos is the one who runs off at the end, leaving Papageno to comfort Pamina. "Your mother has sent Prince Tamino to save you," he explains, and the two then sing about the joys of marital love while they await the arrival of the rescuing hero. Tamino, however, has discovered that things are more complicated than he thought. Zarastro is the head of a priestly temple, and although he may be the base, he's not the bad guy. An old priest explains that it is the Queen of the Night, not Zarastro, whom Tamino should fear. He finds Papageno and Pamina with the help of the bells and the flute. But no sooner are the three united than they are all captured and brought before Sarastro. Pamina begs Sarastro for forgiveness, explaining that her escape attempt was inspired by Monostatos, who was trying to rape her. Sarastro forgives her, but says she cannot return to her untrustworthy mother. Pamina must be guided by a man. When Monostatos, who was off stage when Pamina made her accusation against him, demands a reward for recapturing the fugitives, Sarastro orders him punished. The first act ends with Sarastro announcing that Tamino must undergo initiation into the Temple of Wisdom if he is to be worthy of Pamina. Unexpected as this turnaround is, the forces of good turning out to be evil and vice versa, it provides a rich field for interpretation. Of all the modern interpretations of the magic flute, Ingmar Bergman's 1975 movie is the most famous. But it's not the only landmark production of the 20th century, many of which take very different approaches to the story. Director Peter Sellers' 1990 production for the Glyndebourne Festival was both controversial and provocative. Sellers cut the dialogue, which not only makes up a substantial portion of the piece, but carries much of the plot development. And he sets the piece on the west coast of the United States in the 1950s. The genies became skateboarders. The three ladies were a pop vocal trio, perhaps the Andrews Sisters or the Supremes. Most surprisingly, Sarastro becomes a cult leader. If Sellers is unconvinced of Sarastro's goodness, the 2006 Kenneth Branagh film almost takes the opposite extreme. Set during World War I, Branagh renders Sarastro as the leader of a battlefield hospital seeking, above all, peace. Schikaneder's libretto leaves ample room for such varied interpretations. If Sarastro is good, why is he initially presented as evil? Why does he employ the clearly evil Monostatos? And what exactly is the Temple of Wisdom? It's this last question that leads us to an interpretation that, although little used today, was most likely at the forefront of the composer's own mind. The Freemasons are one of the oldest fraternal organizations, supposedly tracing their origins back to fraternities of actual stonemasons in the 15th century. Mozart was a member of a prestigious lodge, and he explicitly incorporated into the magic flute elements of Masonic ritual, symbolism, and even Masonic music. Illuminati and mystical societies have neither the social cachet nor the political power that they held in Mozart's day, and 20th century interpreters, therefore, tend to downplay the Masonic elements. But Freemasonry does explain one element of the magic flute that is otherwise perplexing to modern audiences. What was the place of women? The first act ends with Sarastro patronizingly telling Pamina that she must submit to the judgment of a man. But when the opera ends, she not only shares in Tamino's tests for induction into the temple, he depends on her to withstand those trials. It's not a stretch to think that Pamina is intended to be co-leader of the temple with her new husband once Sarastro retires. The question of female Masonic lodges was a hot topic in Mozart's day, and his opera gives us much room for thought about where he stood on the matter. Freemasonry also explains, in part, the surprising change of direction that the opera takes after Tamino arrives at the temple. Snakes and padlocks were important symbols to the nascent female Freemason temples. Is the Queen of the Night the leader of such a temple? The Freemasons were strongly influenced by the Enlightenment, and the idea of a benevolent but absolute ruler, usually male, is another core component of the opera. There is always room for one more interpretation of the magic flute. Act 2 opens with a priestly chorus. Sarastro calls upon the gods Isis and Osiris to protect Tamino and Pamina. you may well wonder what the Egyptian goddess and god Isis and Osiris have to do with anything. This is in part a Masonic reference, the Freemasons having drawn on Egyptian symbolism for their own rituals. But it also reveals to us something about Shikaneda's sources for the magic flute. Shikaneda borrowed from texts as diverse as the medieval romance Ewen, by French troubadour Chrétien de Troyes, the 18th century novel Sethos, and an essay entitled On the Mysteries of the Egyptians by Ignaz von Born. Ewen was a knight at King Arthur's court and a friend of the better known Sir Gawain. Sethos was a religiously minded pharaoh, mentioned in the histories of Herodotus, but co-opted by the 18th century French author Jean Terrasson as a vehicle for backdating Masonic rituals into Egyptian history. And Ignaz was a prominent Freemason in Vienna in Mozart's day, equally bent on providing an ancient pedigree for Masonic ritual. It's those rituals that Tamino and Papageno must now undergo to be inducted into the temple. They're ordered to maintain silence, which Tamino does when the Queen's three ladies appear and try to draw them out. Meanwhile, the Queen appears to Pamina and gives her a dagger, ordering her, in another killer coloratura aria, to use it to kill Zarastro. When you make that much of a racket, people are likely to hear you. Monostatos has been listening, and he threatens to reveal the queen's plot to Zarastro unless Pamina submits herself to him. But Zarastro has also heard it all, and he assures Pamina that such evil has no place within the holy walls of the temple. This is extremely understanding of Zarastro. If the Peter Sellers and Kenneth Branagh interpretations of the magic flute emphasize myth and mysticism, Bergman takes a different approach. Zarastro is often thought to be Pamina's father, but this is not stated in the libretto. It makes sense, however, as it explains both Zarastro's care for Pamina and his testy relationship with the Queen of the Night, an otherwise unexplained figure. Bergman also emphasized the theatrical nature of the piece. The film gives constant glimpses of the audience, as well as backstage peeks at the performers. This explains the mythic nature of the story, and it is this theatrical aspect to the piece that Lyric's production, directed by Australian theatre and opera director Neil Armfield, builds upon. In Armfield's vibrant interpretation, The Magic Flute is a story told by children at a family gathering. Having the story told by children can explain both the larger-than-life situations and the plot's many twists and turns. Two such turns are the surprisingly dark scenes in which both Pamina and Papageno face mortality. Having the story told by children will not, I believe, lose the impact of these scenes, but it may lessen the dissonance they create in an otherwise comic opera. While being tested, Papageno is introduced to an old woman, actually the young and beautiful Papagena in disguise. When she reveals herself to him, the priests whisk her away, sending Papageno into despair. Pamina is similarly affected by Tamino's refusal to speak to her. She doesn't realize his vow of silence is one of his tests. She's so distraught that she contemplates suicide, but is dissuaded by the three genies. Papageno's exchange with Papagena has disqualified him from membership in the temple, but Pamina now joins Tamino for the final tests of fire and water. Protected by the magic flute, the two lovers pass the tests and are welcomed by the priests. There is now one more near suicide, though done in a comical way. Papageno threatens to hang himself until the genies tell him to play his magic bells. He does so, summoning Papagena to be his wife. Just as Tamino and Papageno are now on the side of Zarastro, Monostatos has also switched sides. He joins the Queen of the Night in an attempt to destroy the temple, but their plot is quickly quashed. The opera ends with Zarastro, Tamino and Pamina hailing the triumph of light over darkness and welcoming in a new age of fortitude, beauty and wisdom.
Thank you.